Welcome, everyone, to City Line Real on Race. This week, we are talking about activism. I just want to take a quick moment to talk about how amazed and excited I am about the amount of engagement we had over our first episode last week here on YouTube. The comments were over the top that most people just did not have a good understanding of Black Canadian history and how much of Black history is Canadian history. So thank you. And I hope that that is the beginning of the conversation wherever you live in this country or wherever you live on the planet. So today it's all about activism. And I'm very excited about this because you can talk and talk and talk, but acting is really where it's at if you are really invested in helping to eliminate anti-Black racism. I have an incredible panel today. So I'm going to start with Sadie Keene, who is our human rights and justice activist. She is in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us, Sadie. We have Sandy Hudson, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto. She is currently in LA. Welcome. And we have Robin Maynard, author of Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada, From Slavery to the Present. And right now, Robin is also joining us in Toronto. Thank you so much for joining us today. Since we're talking about activism, I wanted to give a sense of the history of activism in Canada. And by all means, this isn't comprehensive. I want to hit on some big actions that have happened in the past that really set the scene for the fact that anti-Black racism has never been okay in Canada. There have been people screaming about it for generations now, but this is information not a lot of us know. And I want to start out in Montreal in 1969 at Sir George Williams University, now known as Concordia. There was a 13-day sit-in there. And Robin, you can give us a little bit of context around that if you don't mind.
Absolutely. And I mean, first, just to mention that, you know, from when enslaved Black peoples used to run away from their purported owners in Montreal to Malcolm X's mother, Louise Little, who actually lived in Montreal, that it's long been a hotbed of Black resistance and rebellion. So, of course, the Sir George Williams Affair, as it's called now, is a really important site of transnational Black activism, of Black activism in Canada, and also a really important site of where we can see the violent policing of Black activism taking place, where we saw Black Caribbean students who were originally just contesting the fact that there was racial discrimination in terms of the grades that they had experienced, trying to address this within the administration. And after months and months of delays, eventually organized protests against racial discrimination at the university, which turned into a 13-day sit-in. Now, this is often described as a riot, but it's important to remember that it was when the riot police were sent in that this became, you know, what's commonly known, again, as the riots. And in the end, a fire ended up being set, and people outside now infamously were yelling, "Let the N-words burn," at this time. We ended up seeing the mass arrest of Black students and other students who had occupied the computer center, of course, the fire, as well as subsequently, arrests, charge, and deportations of that were leveled at many of these Caribbean students. So we can look at this as a way that Black students, of course, were experiencing racism and also experiencing extreme violence, police response to their protests, as well as the violence coming from the immigration system afterward.
A huge, huge price to pay for those who did speak up, particularly the leaders of that action. Rosie Douglas was one of them, deported from Canada and went on to become the leader of Dominica in his original country. So a huge price to pay for speaking out, but it has happened. I want to talk quickly about a couple of Black enclaves in Canada, Africville and in Halifax and Hogan's Alley in Vancouver. And Sadie, you live out west, you're very connected to Hogan's Alley, but maybe you could give us a quick word on both. Sure.
I think that it's really important to talk about Halifax and the commitment there from descendants of the loyalists that came to Canada, what their parents found when they got here, and what they continue to experience. Again, we talk about what happened in terms of promises made by the Crown to Indigenous people, and we can't forget that in our dual experiences, but we also must talk about the commitment that was made by the Crown to the Loyalists and how little was delivered on those promises. And the fact that Black Canadians have fought in Halifax and other places for their rights to safety, security, health, and education, and that they are still fighting those same battles today. And in BC, we've had a similar situation. Our community here, Hogan's Alley in Vancouver, was not a very big community, and it was really a cultural center and home. It was safety for any, for both artists that came here, but also for anyone traveling through BC or to BC. And it was eliminated when BC and Vancouver specifically decided to put in a highway through the area. So the housing that was there was destroyed. The sense of community that Black people had in a one spot was eliminated. And again, issues around health, education, employment are still key matters here. And not only Vancouver, because sometimes we get caught up in saying, oh, well, it's only in Vancouver, but throughout BC. And again, Black people have been a part of many parts of this province since the 1800s. And most people forget that as well. But I'll stop there because I think there's a much broader discussion to be had around all of those elements. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I want to fast forward then to the creation of the Black Action Defense Committee in Toronto, which, you know, I was probably in grade 8 or grade 9 when BADC was created, and it had an effect on my upbringing for sure. We would see Dudley Laws in press conferences, and you know, it would be one Black murder after another by police here, and no one was saying anything but BADC. And so at some point there were so many instances of police brutality against Black men in Toronto that a peaceful protest happened down Yonge Street, known now as the Yonge Street Uprising, in 1992. And, you know, in the end, it ended up taking on a little bit more of a riot-like atmosphere. But the point was, BADC wanted changes. And actually, out of the Black Action Defense Committee, the SIU was created in 1990, which is interesting, and which is something I want to touch on a little bit later, because at the time, it was seen as a win, and I don't know if it is seen as a win now. If it's effective, I don't know. But we're going to talk about that, and I want to talk about the manifestation of activism that a lot of us are seeing in the news and in newspapers and on television in the United States and in Canada, and it's Black Lives Matter. So the creation of Black Lives Matter Toronto, Sandy, this is an organization that you were a part of. Did you help create Black Lives Matter in Toronto?
Yeah.
When did that happen and why did it happen?
That happened in 2014. What happened then was at around the same time that Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson in the United States, Jermaine Carby was murdered in Brampton, a suburb of Toronto. And we were seeing a lot on the news, like Canadian media loves to focus on anti-Black racism in the United States, and they should. That is something worthy that we should know about, but doesn't tend to show the same amount of information for things that are happening in our own communities here in Canada. So we were seeing a lot of information about the process, what had happened, protests in the United States with respect to Michael Brown. And there was almost no information with respect to Jermaine Carby. And so At the time, activists in the United States had called for worldwide solidarity actions. And I was a student organizer. I was interested in attending one. I tried to find one and I couldn't. And some people that I know was like, were like, why don't you try to create a solidarity action? You have these skills. You've been doing student protests, organizing student protests for some time. You could probably do this. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to do it, I'll try to get as many of the Black organizers that I know in the city together. And we're going to talk about Jermaine Kirby because people need to know that, you know, this is an issue also in our community. And we're not going to forget the people who have been killed by police in our community. And we're not going to pretend like this is not an issue in our community. And so we contacted Jermaine Kirby's family. And we created, we organized a protest over a couple of days to happen in front of the U.S. consulate. And at that time, I was a pretty seasoned organizer. I knew, you know, given the 2 days that we really focused on organizing, that we'd only really organized for about 500 people to show up. That was what we expected. And in fact, 3,000 people showed up to that first protest. And then so after that, we had a conversation about whether or not it would be responsible to just leave it at one protest or if there was a need for a mobilizing force in the city to talk about anti-Blackness because, you know, people had traveled for, you know, from some of our farther suburbs to come down to that protest. Some people were hearing about Jermaine Kirby for the first time and were outraged. And we thought, We better continue organizing as an organization and not just leave it at this.
I think it's a really good point because we are consuming American news like crazy and we consume American history like crazy. And that's the reason why we're doing this YouTube series. We have a history here. We have a problem here. So if we're not talking about it, how are we going to solve it? I want to talk about one demand. There are many demands from Black Lives Matter Toronto, but one that we've seen is quite radical, but is now gaining a groundswell of support, is this idea of defunding the police. Can you explain what that means?
Sure, yeah, I can. And just to note something that you just said, I thought was really important. It's like, yeah, we focus a lot on American history, but I think we also have to stop thinking about the history of this place as like as siloed and distinct, like that there's a Canadian history and there's an American history. I mean, police departments, you know, there are police in Canada who go down to Florida to get trained in new techniques and so on. So I think we have to start recognizing that our histories are intertwined and that, like, you know, the imaginary line of the border doesn't stop the fact that the colonization is coming from a few places and a lot of where our troubles lie come from the same underlying principles and the same underlying institutions. But yes, defunding the police, very important and almost no-brainer idea. But it took a long time for us to get here where we could start, we could talk about it so frankly in the media. What we mean when we say defund the police is that right now the services that we have in place in our society to provide safety and security to all of us, one, aren't doing a very good job, and two, are killing Black and Indigenous people. And so it is worth it for us as a society, as a whole, to take a look at such a service and say, well, why are we funding a service that is killing people? And why are we funding a service that does not work? And think about creating new services. It's at the simplest, most basic level, that's what defunding the police means.
So when people say, okay, if you're defunding police, does that mean when there's a violent crime like a bank robbery, what happens if there's no one around to handle that? What would you answer to that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I know that sometimes when people first hear the idea defund the police, what they hear is take away my safety, because, you know, we've been taught that police equals safety for so long. Let's go through that thought experiment. What happens when there is a bank robbery? It is very, very rare that the police are ever involved in some sort of violent crime where they're intervening, where something is happening and they're intervening. They're typically called after the fact. Police do not prevent violent crime. Violent crime continues to happen in our society, as we know. And then the police respond to that. With respect to thefts and robbery, people might be surprised to know that the clearance rate for theft and robbery is 16%, is less than 16%. And that's the Statistics Canada data. And what clearance rate means is not how many crimes are solved, but it means how many crimes, when there's a theft or a robbery, where a charge is laid. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the crime is solved, but just that a charge is laid. Less than 16% of cases. So in fact, the police are doing a really terrible job with respect to that, providing that service. With respect to theft and robbery altogether, your insurance company is far more helpful to you with respect to something like that. In the event that, you know, there is a violent crime where we do need some sort of intervention, I do think that we need to have some sort of service that provides violence intervention strategies in our society. I still don't know if the police are the best place to go to do that. And one of the reasons, like when I think about why, the case that always comes up in my mind is the Quebec City massacre. When that happened and the police were called and again showed up after the fact, because they typically show up after something has already been completed, violent crime has already been completed, people described who Alexandre Bissonnette was. Of course, at the time, they didn't know his name, but they described him as white, as a man. And even still, the police started detaining the brown men in the mosque because they have this connection to how they view who can be a perpetrator and who is not a perpetrator, that they ended up inflicting more trauma and violence on these people who had already just been through a very horrific experience. And so I think that if the police are so attached to viewing us in that way, then we really got to think, like, you know, that person could have gotten away forever. We really have to think about how we are tackling these problems in our society and how we're keeping each other safe. And I think that Black and Indigenous lives are worth investigating something completely different.
Robin, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would be happy to. And thank you so much, Sandy, for really breaking that down so clearly. I think that what we're seeing right now is a context where across North American cities, across the United States, and across Canada, we're having an increasing recognition that policing is itself something that is not reformable, that is actually a kind of violence against our communities. This has been true, for generations, for centuries, that, you know, for example, in Toronto, we know that Black people are 20 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than white residents of Toronto. So in understanding this as a kind of violence, it's looking at what it can actually mean to defund, to dismantle, and to diminish the powers of policing and the violence that accompanies it in as many ways that we can. So one of the ways that we're seeing a really strong push, in Toronto, Black Lives Matter calling for a 50% reduction is this: to reduce the budget of policing, looking at the massive social expenditures that we have in policing compared to almost any other social good that actually helps people, like social and community housing, for one example, like women's shelters, like all of the, there are so many mechanisms to keep people safe that are drastically underfunded while we continue to pour over $1 billion of the Toronto municipal budget into policing, over $15 billion nationally, even as so many other absolutely necessary and life-saving mechanisms are underfunded. We're also looking at a push to reduce the scope of policing. So right now we have up to 80% of police responses, according to Statistics Canada, are relating to the examples they give being mental health, drug overdose, domestic disputes. Well, we know that drug users, advocates have been talking for a long time now about how police actually responding to overdose calls means that people are not calling the police and the people are actually dying unnecessarily of overdose deaths. We know that when it comes to mental health crises, we see what recently happened to Regis Karshinsky-Peke, an Afro-Indigenous woman who fell to her death, and DeAndre Campbell as well. We know that it's not an adequate response. The policing is not an adequate response to mental health and domestic disputes. We have documentation all across North America that shows us that Black women and Indigenous women especially are victimized by the police often when they actually call in response to domestic violence. So again, it's about reducing the scope of things that that people are starting to realize that police are not and have never been equipped to do. Reducing the scope of policing removing police from schools, where police, of course, never had any business in being, where we know that things like school counselors, like after school programs are underfunded. And instead we have the presence of law enforcement officers, where we see incidents like that 6-year-old girl who, of course, was handcuffed, hand and foot together in a Peel region school. So it's about, again, minimizing the scope of policing in our society, demilitarizing police. In Halifax, for example, we just saw almost $500,000 was going to go towards a tank. And because of protests led by Black community members there, including Elle Jones and others, finally, although this was something that was laughed about, they were mocked for bringing up months ago, now we actually see that $500,000 is going to be diverted into community. So it's about divesting from all the vast sums of money that goes into policing and redirecting that into community supports, into mechanisms that could actually keep our community members safe, like community-led anti-violence programs, like non-police-based mental health supports, as Sandy had so carefully outlined for us.
Some people have said, we've seen defunding. It's just been happening in healthcare and education. So it's actually not that crazy an idea. We live with defunding and all these other industries. I just want to ask, how far are you getting? I've heard about the Toronto Police, the mayor saying maybe 10%, looking at defunding about 10%. The ask is for 50%. How far are you getting? Are people listening? Is there a connection with the levels of government and what you're asking for, Sandy?
Well, the city council, I mean, not the mayor. The mayor is not interested in defunding the police at all. And I think that is just goes to show, you know, how he feels about Black communities. Quite frankly, I think he's been quite destructive for some time. But yesterday there was a Toronto City Council meeting where there was a motion on the agenda to reduce the police budget by 10%, which failed. It's really interesting because most of the councillors talked about how they had between 30,000 and 60,000 emails from residents asking to defund the police. And for them to make that choice, I've been really stunned by how popular an idea this is. I mean, we are having protests from Whitehorse down to Windsor, from PEI, over to Victoria, all across Canada, in the smallest towns, in the biggest cities, people have been having protests. And in most of those places, there's been at least more than one. And the politicians are really, really quiet. I've never seen an issue get so much support on the ground. And, you know, as I was reflecting on this the other day, it's like, sometimes people ask us, well, why do you have to say Black Lives Matter? Is there any more proof than this many people saying, hey, government, we want you to change something? And for so many of them to either be quiet or to just say, oh, we don't want to talk about it or completely disagree or say that they're wrong. They're talking about an American problem that doesn't exist here. I mean, that's why we have to say Black Lives Matter. Black and Indigenous people are so undervalued in our community that we can have all of this evidence of the fact that this exists here in Canada as a huge problem for police violence against Black and Indigenous people. We can have all of these people impassionately saying, this needs to change. My family's been hurt. I have been hurt. My community's been hurt. We can have all of these people taking to the streets for sustained protests that we have never seen in this country before. I mean, we're trying to track it. We have over 70 cities on an Excel spreadsheet, and it's not a complete list. And we have seen from Justin Trudeau what? Kneeling at a protest, but not taking any action whatsoever when he has the power to do so, and in particular with the RCMP. We haven't heard much at all from the Conservative Party except discussions about whether or not systemic racism actually exists. Same thing with the Parti Québécois. And the NDP, there's been discussions about racism, but no actual, like federally, no actual plan of what to do about police violence in our communities. Provincially, Doug Ford has decided to like hire someone to look into anti-Black racism, which just doesn't do anything. The Liberal Party has said literally nothing in Ontario, zero, about this. And the NDP did put out a comprehensive plan of how to approach defunding the police, which people should look at. And I should mention also federally, 144 MPs, mostly Liberals and NDP MPs, have signed on to a document endorsing defunding the police in a comprehensive plan that sounds wonderful, but it's very hard to find. It's not on any website because no party has endorsed it as a whole, but almost a majority of MPs have. So they know that it's so popular, they have to say something about it, but still they haven't done anything about it. And that just makes me so frustrated. How could you know and see all of the frustration out on our streets, 60,000 phone calls, something that you have never seen before, as these city councilors were saying, but still do nothing? Now, it's not all bad news. You know, in Hamilton, they have eliminated police from their school district as part of this moment. And I know other cities across Canada are having votes of up to 30% defunding. And certainly in Minneapolis, they've decided to abolish their police department. In Oakland, they've decided to completely disarm their frontline police officers. So, you know, this movement is resulting in change. But the problem in Canada with respect to anti-Black racism is often denial and turning away from the problem. And I think we see that continuing today. And it is just so reprehensible.
I'm going to throw the question out there. Does activism work? I know in the end, like you see the frustration, you see everybody's talking about it. This is global now. There are white people in the streets and they are fighting and they are saying they don't want to live in a country or a world like this. And then you still have decision makers not pushing anything forward. So just moving away specifically about police brutality, because activism comes in many forms. For Sadie, does activism work? And in which ways does it work? And what should we be considering if we want to start acting?
I think that activism really does work. Putting things out in public, speaking about them, and pressing for change is the way to have it happen. When Black Lives Matter first came into fold, there were all kinds of people who were concerned about using the words, right, that is implying that Black people mattered. Now there is generally not a question about whether or not Black lives matter, and that city councils in Canada and in the U.S., the councilors are up and talking about anti-Black racism, which what, 3 months ago, they would have never done so. Defunding the police is something that has been talked about. And in fact, there are more discussion about that and where money is going that could be going to other services and supports for a larger group of people is a part of the ongoing discussion right now. More and more resources for health and other supports for everyone. I just think that without those individuals who are on the front lines willing to raise their voices about the need for change and articulate a vision of some of where we need to be, there will be no discussion and no action taken. The discussion about the NDP, the one thing that we can say about the Prime Minister is that a year ago, he talked about anti-Black racism. He was pressed to, he was forced to, but he did talk about it. And now most premiers across the nation actually can now articulate it. And last week, I live in BC, and I used to be active and really involved in the NDP across the country. The reality is that it's not been until the last 2 months that the premier here actually articulated the discussion around anti-Black racism and actually put out a statement. There are all kinds of districts, most districts in BC in the last couple of weeks have voted on the possibility of eliminating police from all schools, which again is a major step for most of them. I can talk about some other provinces too that have had the similar kinds of initiatives underway. And I think the writing is on the wall. This is not something that most parents now think is okay, the policing of our children. And I think that come September, that many schools will have be clear in their statement that police will no longer be in their schools.
I want to bring in an activist who doesn't even call himself an activist, but he's acting and he's making change. Daniel Afalabi, who is in Vancouver right now, he has created a petition with just under 38,000 signatures. And this is to restructure, he's from Alberta, the Alberta curriculum. Daniel, you grew up in Okotoks, Alberta. So
yes.
You were the only Black person in your school. What prompted you to actually start this petition and change the curriculum?
Well, I actually graduated with two other Black people, but I guess that's basically the only one. But yeah, when the George Floyd stuff happened and Breonna Taylor and all the killings of a lot of Black people and police brutality happening here in Canada as well, it kind of affected me a lot harder than, I guess, the killings in the past. And I'd been posting on Instagram and all that, but I kind of felt like I wouldn't be able to at least feel a bit more peace unless I did something. So myself and my friend Eric, who is white, we kind of put together this petition and we kind of just put it out there. We didn't think it would go as far as it's going. So even being here is like a little overwhelming just because I didn't think like anything like this would come out of it. So yeah, that was kind of the thought process behind it. We kind of just thought maybe here in Alberta is something where we can do something. And I kind of felt that Black history had been pretty much overlooked, and speaking to a lot of my other Black friends in Calgary as well, they kind of felt the same. And we kind of thought this would be one thing that we could do to at least push for a change.
So I would love to spread that sentiment. Like Sadie says, activism does count. You will probably get a change based on your action, just like Robin is, just like Sandy is, just like Sadie is. So what did you say to people outside of your community to get them on board? And what kind of activism do you see as really moving the dial right now for you and your friends, Daniel?
Well, to get other people on board, we kind of just put out the petition, asked my parents to share it, like all of my friends to share it. And then I also posted on Instagram, like kind of like an infographic explaining everything. And we really tried to like hammer down that this isn't a political issue. It's kind of just an issue that all Albertans should care about. And once we kind of like hammered that down, it was really nice to see all the support come from out of that. And then I guess, sorry, could you repeat the second part of the question?
What do you think, when you talk to your friends, do you think they would be more likely to sign a petition, or do you think that they would actually be okay with changing the way they move through the world? Like, I'm going to sign this petition, which is amazing, but I'm wondering, how do we get to the next step? Do they seem open to thinking differently?
Yeah, they seem open. Like, a lot of conversations I've had with my friends is that, like, or at least my white friends and friends that aren't Black, like, it's great to sign the petition and post on Instagram, but like, a big thing is, what do you say when someone says something racist and I'm not there? Or like, how do you attack racism when there's nobody watching you? Like, I think it's really important to hold yourself accountable and to hold others accountable, even if a Black person isn't in the room. And I think that's a big part of kind of like enacting change, even like a small thing you can do to enact change, like, by yourself.
I agree 100%. And can you keep in touch with us and let us know how your petition goes? Because it would be great to see some movement in the curriculum there. You had a really hard time when they were reading books with the N-bomb. I read that people would actually be pointing at you in your class.
Yeah, like, it's when you're one of the only Black people in school, you kind of become a point of reference, like, to all Black people, and it's really exhausting. So I'm glad this petition is kind of, hopefully will change some things like that.
Daniel, thank you so much for everything you and your friends are doing. How does someone move from just being sympathetically against anti-Black racism to actually standing in that space and acting? What are the steps? What are the advice that you could give folks that are watching this stream right now? Robin, I'll start with you.
I think, first of all, I really just want to highlight the fact that at this time, you know, we often look back and people like to ask this hypothetical question, what would you do in the time of slavery? What would you do, you know, in these historical times that we identify injustice during Jim Crow United States? But we need to understand that if we're looking at the mass police killings, the incarceration of Black people, the kinds of violence that Black people are enduring in schools, in the child welfare system, at the hands of police and prisons in this country, we need to ask ourselves those exact questions about right now. We have a mass movement across North America that's questioning the very legitimacy of policing itself. This is something that has been naturalized, that we've been taught is necessary, that we couldn't live without for hundreds of years. Now, we need to remember that the institution of slavery at one time was also understood as something that was permanent, enduring, and could never end. And yet people fought and imagined something else and demanded a different future. So at this time, it's important for all of us, again, to jump into the present moment and say that we will do whatever it takes, just as we imagine our past selves having, you know, doing whatever it would have taken to end the very violent institutions of the past. And we need to ask that same moral question of ourselves right now. And there are so many different spheres, especially at this time, where it's possible to be involved. If you have a child in public school, which so many families do, or private school for that matter, pushing to get police and policing out of schools and have that money redirected, particularly towards Black and other marginalized students, that's something that any parent can do. You know, the police budget in every municipality is something that, again, is taxpayer dollars. That's public money. So being involved to change the direction of that public money to be directed towards the people who have so historically been denied, you know, even being considered the public, the Black and Indigenous residents of the cities that we live in. There are so many different angles and ways in which Black people are fighting for justice across the country at this time, whether that's, you know, for the undocumented Black Haitian communities who are serving on the front line of the COVID-19 pandemic at this time, for agricultural workers, for status for all migrants. There are so many integral points of a struggle at this time that there's almost too many for me to list here. So I think that choosing one, choosing two, choosing three, where you have your power, where you have the most push in your own capacity, and deciding that there is no choice but to double down on that right now.
Good. Okay. That's great, Robin. Sadie, what do you think? What would you say to people watching right now that are thinking, I don't know what to do? Like, how do I act? What do I do to be an activist in this situation?
Like Robin, I think that where we are right now is that most people, given the protests and much of the discussions that are taking place, feel that they can be engaged. And that also, I think that, as Daniel said, having us reflect and take on matters individually as well as collectively, is really, really key. I always have thought that Black folks know kind of what isn't working. The challenge always is how do we get other people to listen and hear and connect with what we're saying and recognize, going back to something that Robin and Sandy said earlier, recognizing our humanness and our humanity and tying that into all of the work that we all do, that collectively we do and our allies also take part in doing. It seems to me that some of what we all need to do right now is light a fire under our politician to get off their duffs and actually start supporting programs that help help bring about true equality. So to connect with what is laid out in the Constitution in the U.S., but also our charter, that we are supposed to be able to experience the very best, be able to make for ourselves the kind of life that we desire in safety and without fear. That is not something that has been delivered by our politicians, and certainly won't be delivered in a police state, which really came out of slavery. So again, having our politicians understand that if they don't begin to take action on the matters that we've identified as priorities, then they will not be there for much longer. And I think what we can do is get ourselves together and figure out the people who are committed to the matters and the issues that we want to have happen, and then us and them get them elected. When we are talking, one of the things that continue to come up for me as a grandmother and a mother of young men and young women is the fact that they are often not seen to be important and valued. And every day that they go out in the world, that there's a possibility that they may not come home. And that isn't in the U.S., that is in Canada. And I do not want that to continue to be a situation for other Black people in our communities. Other Black people and other Indigenous people need to know that they have a right to protection and safety. And we are, I think, collectively as community, are the people who can deliver that in all the ways that are necessary.
Thank you, Sandy. I'm really happy that the onus was put on humanity, because when you talk about any of this, none of this should really be a debate. It's about humanity, you know, it's about treating people as human beings. Sandy, I'll let you have the last word. If someone is watching this right now and thinking, I need to make a change, I want to act, I want to do something, how would you advise them?
Thank you. I think that what we're really talking about here is like such a shift that it requires us to be able to imagine something different. And I truly believe that in the future, we're going to look back at this moment and be like, we had a service that was killing groups of people that didn't do a good job at basically anything, and nobody wanted to do anything. And look at the people who are making the decisions, like what was made yesterday at Toronto City Council, and say, you know, John Tory presided over a decision where this was going to keep going. And I'm like, one, who wants to be that guy? Who wants to be remembered as that? In the end, when, you know, this ultimately has to change. There's too many people now who have done the investigation, who know more than they did 2 months ago. We have shifted culture significantly. So now culture is aware that policing doesn't work. And so it is now only a matter of time before we significantly change how we shift safety and security services in our society. And so for people who are thinking, how can I be a part of that change? We're all going to have different levels of ability to be involved. So I'm going to give a few ideas. If you have the capacity to join an organization that is working on this work, join an organization that's working on this work. Do that. If you don't have that capacity, perhaps you're working and or you have family responsibilities that doesn't allow you to have extra time to join an organization, one of the things that you can do to help shift this culture, to help shift this power, is in whatever institutions that you are engaged in, have conversations with people in those institutions to shift how they're thinking about this issue. And I'm talking about the institution of your family. Like, let's start there. If you're in a class somewhere, ask the teacher if you can address the classroom beforehand on this issue. You know, this has been on my mind. Can we talk about it? If you attend a religious congregation of some kind, see if you can have a conversation with the people who are in that congregation about this issue of defunding the police. And I have to co-sign what Sadie and Robin have said, become engaged politically as well. These politicians are ignoring what's happening because they think that they can. So part of your action, if you can't have a conversation with your institution, at least pick up the phone or send an email out to say, be counted amongst that 60,000 and growing who are saying, we do not stand for this anymore. Because if they think they can ignore us, they can think that they can ignore us all they want. But eventually, once a culture shifts, and it's already shifted, things will not remain the same. And so it's not a question of whether or not policing will change. The question is when. There are too many people who know what only a few of us knew a few months ago.
Dreaming for years and years and years. It's amazing to see the shift. And thank you for being every single one of you, Daniel Afolabi, Robin Maynard, Sandy Hudson, Sadie Keene, thank you for your inspiration. I think it's incredible to see people who are actively engaged in the struggle and just to get like a little bit of that sprinkling of magic so that we can all go back to our communities and make the changes we need to make. Thanks all of you for joining me today. And I know they're all super busy. So the fact that you made time for this, I appreciate it. Subscribe to CityLine's YouTube channel. We've got more of these coming up next week. We're talking about white privilege. We're talking about white fragility. We are talking about allyship, how to do it the right way. That's all happening next Tuesday at 3 p.m. here on CityLine Real, live on race. And thanks for joining us, everyone. Have a great day.